We understand your problem. We sympathize wholeheartedly with your goal of a healthy economy. We suggest only that the application of your surcharge to
Canada... Premier Trudeau of Canada is somewhat understanding of U.S. problems. Some other nations are equally sympathetic. Still others feel differently. We will look at both sides of the coin.
This is Second Sunday, NBC's award-winning news documentary series. This month's topic, A World Reflection, How They See Us. Here is your host, Wilson Hall.
Never in our history as a world power has the image of the United States been at such a low ebb. We were riding high until the 60s. Then it seemed something or some things, fate, kismet, pulled the rug from under us. We became ensnarled in the race issue with all its concomitant aspects, poverty, riot, busing, segregation, desegregation, you name it. We are frustrated and guilty, and we're being drained. And in the 60s, we became more deeply mired in the Vietnam War. Now, 40,000 American deaths later, we are trying to extricate ourselves. But the fact remains, we still are in Vietnam. As a result, we're not the sure-footed power we were. Following our assumption of world leadership after World War II, we are like the giant Gulliver, bound up by the Lilliputians, our problems. As a nation, we have tried, we believe it can be argued, we have tried to behave decently by international standards. But it seems to little, or perhaps no, avail. We still flounder in the race issue, we still flounder in Vietnam, and to top it off, the value of the American dollar is in question. These are indeed strange times. Because of these facts, we've asked our correspondents around the world to advise us how the nations around the world see us, you and me, and our nation. Within the coming hour, we plan to pursue this inquiry along three broad lines: economic aspects, domestic issues, and the field of foreign affairs. First, as to foreign affairs, how do the British view us?
This is George Montgomery in London, to be exact, on Fleet Street, the capital's newspaper row, which helps make and reflect British attitudes on American foreign policy. For the last year or so, there has been a growing feeling that the Americans were learning, in Vietnam and elsewhere, that their power had limitations, and accordingly, the Americans were trying to pull in their horns. Now comes the dollar crisis, and the weekly magazine, The New Statesman, says that the actions of the Nixon administration have ended an era, not just in world economics, but in world politics. The Statesman goes on that the Americans have found their resources so overstretched that they have curtly abdicated as the world's number one nanny or nursemaid. The Statesman adds that what it calls the American empire has now crumbled, and that in a few months' time, people will be talking not about Fort Knox, but about Fortress America. That's a fairly typical left-wing view, but the right is making similar noises, with the Sunday Telegraph mentioning what it calls Mr. Nixon's new policy of enlightened isolationism. The Telegraph, along with other commentators, is saying that if the liberated dollar is the economic symbol of this enlightened isolationism, its military equivalent could well be heavy domestic American pressure for cuts in U.S. troops in Europe. Many middle-of-the-road Britons claim that America's new, more realistic, less aggressive attitudes about the limitations of its power augur well for peace. They say an American president may be going to Peking 20 years later than he could have gone, but at least he is going, and not arrogantly. This is George Montgomery on Fleet Street in London.
The British viewpoint, as might be expected, is rather tempered. Traditionally, the British have been our allies, although they were, ironically, our first foe. How about our other traditional ally, France? However, a word of caution, it must be remembered that it was General de Gaulle about 10 years ago who suggested cutting France away from the United States. His idea was the creation of a third force to counterbalance the two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union.
This is David Burrington in Paris. The French rarely criticize the goals of American foreign policy. In fact, opinion surveys of the past 5 years show that Frenchmen rate the U.S. far ahead of any other country as France's best friend. But when it comes to how the U.S. tries to achieve its goals, well, French criticism is often harsh. For example, there's general approval of President Nixon's decision to wind down the Vietnam War. But French newspapers still sputter that Vietnamization won't work. And the most influential paper, Le Monde, has advised Mr. Nixon to take a closer look at the recent seven-point Viet Cong peace proposal. It's American policy toward Europe, however, that the French are touchiest about. President Pompidou has noted that the U.S. always says it's in favor of the common market, but he doubts American leaders are really ready to face the consequences. The major consequence, the French insist, will be less American influence in Europe. This is a sore point. The weekly magazine L'Express recently blamed the current dollar crisis on excessive U.S. investment in Europe, $13 billion worth last year, and it warned that such investment inevitably generates political influence, dollar diplomacy. The French hope to see their own influence in Europe increase as American influence declines. But all this is based on the assumption that Russia is no longer a threat. Any new saber-rattling in Moscow would force a profound reappraisal. David Burrington, NBC News, outside the Foreign Ministry in Paris.
France and Great Britain have been friends in the historic sense. Germany has been our enemy in two world wars. After World War II, we helped put West Germany on its feet, partly because we had to. Germany's geographic position, plus the dynamism of its people, make it a compelling force in world politics. And it can be argued that we acted as we did toward the Germans to prevent a communist takeover of Western Europe in the years following the war. Now, in 1971, how does West Germany view us?
This is Robert Hager in West Berlin. I'm standing beside the Berlin Wall, tall, gray, and ugly. For West Berliners, the specter of communism and the Soviet bloc is never very far away. In spite of the pending Berlin Agreement, West Berliners, and for that matter most West Germans, feel much more secure with the American army around. And that, at the moment, is their number one concern over U.S. foreign policy. A few months ago, when the U.S. Senate was debating a cutback for troops in Europe, the influential newspaper Frankfurter Allgemeine was warning its readers of neo-isolationism in the United States. A few days later, word that the Senate had decided not to tamper with the present troop levels brought a general sigh of relief throughout West Germany. Germans don't see the U.S. presence here as a favor. Over the years, they've come to regard it as an obligation. The defense minister, Helmut Schmidt, once told me Americans should realize the U.S. Army is necessary in Germany not only as a defense for Germany, but in Schmidt's view, as a defense for America itself. West Germany, said Schmidt, just happens to be the front line. Apart from the various negotiations underway with the East, many West Germans will tell you they know the Russians best and the Russians can't be trusted. Whether that be true or not, the Germans feel a lot more comfortable with America in the ring beside them. Withdrawal from other parts of the world may be all right, but the Germans don't want to see American withdrawal from this part of the globe. Robert Hager, alongside the Berlin Wall in West Berlin.
Germany was one of our two major foes in World War II, the other, Japan. It's sometimes interesting to speculate what might have happened if Japan had not made the mistake of bombing Pearl Harbor. For that act solidified American opinion into a determination to defeat the totalitarian powers. The Allies did defeat Germany and Japan, and then the United States rebuilt Japan. That is history. Today is now. What do the Japanese think of us now?
This is John Rich in Tokyo. Japanese policymakers are taking a new look at the United States. For 25 years, or almost as soon as they got used to the American occupation, the Japanese have taken the United States pretty much for granted. The Americans were in Japan, U.S. forces operated from Japanese bases, and the Japanese simply assumed that America needed Japan and would thus take care of Japan. The double Nixon shocks, his announced trip to Peking, and the economic measures have shaken the Japanese as nothing has for years. One Japanese columnist writes that in Japan, the image of a rich America has persisted. It was kept alive by post-war memories of generous aid and Japan's own heavy dependence on the United States, which came to be taken for granted. Because of this, he says, Japan has been reluctant to stand on its own feet. America's moves toward China, made without consulting Japan, have forced the Japanese to think more about their own future policy in Asia. When they think about a role independent from the United States, it seems to many Japanese to be a very lonely one. America's new policy is forcing Japanese diplomats and leaders to face up to the realities of the situation in Asia for the first time since World War II. One result may be that as Japan begins to make its own independent decisions, it may gain a new appreciation of the United States and the protection and help it's received from its conqueror the past quarter century. This is John Rich, NBC News, at the Japanese Foreign Ministry in Tokyo.
We still have troops in Japan and in Germany and in other parts of the world. We have no soldiers in the Middle East. Nevertheless, that area poses a problem for American foreign policy. It is in this area that the interests of the Soviet Union and the United States directly conflict, the two superpowers maneuvering for positions of influence as relations grow ever more tense between the Israelis and the Arab world.
This is Mark Schleifer in Beirut. Part of the way Beirut makes its living is by serving as a propaganda center for all of the conflicting political trends in the Arab world. But over the past year, a shaky common view here towards American policy has emerged, a belief that only the United States has the power to force Israel to make the compromises that the Arab governments insist are necessary if there is ever to be peace in the Middle East. This consensus began to emerge when the more radical Arab states, particularly Egypt and Syria, became convinced that U.S.-sponsored negotiations with Israel was the least painful and most likely way to recover all of the Arab territory lost to Israel during the June 1967 war. The differences then are more those of mood. Newspapers here like Al Anwar, which reflect Egyptian opinion, are still suspicious and always ready to warn that American peace efforts may be just maneuvers to divide the Arabs and buy more time for Israel. The right-wing newspapers here, like El Hayat, which reflect Saudi Arabian and Jordanian opinion, keep urging the Arabs not to alienate the United States with rhetorical threats. Outside of this uneasy consensus stand the Palestinian guerrillas and the small but influential Arab New Left, who argue that the Arabs will never be able to unite or develop their economy unless they mobilize themselves for a revolutionary war, Viet Cong style, against Israel and, if necessary, the United States. This is Mark Schleifer at El Nahar newspaper in Beirut.
The Israelis have forged a powerful nation in the Middle East, powerful because of a strong national will, a will to live, a will to survive.
This is Ken Lukoff in Jerusalem. A frequently heard question here when it comes to politics, peace, social problems, and in fact anything at all, is it good for the Jews, meaning the Jews of Israel? At no time in recent years has that question been heard as often as when talking about American attempts to bring Arabs and Israelis together for a peace settlement. Many Israelis doubt U.S. sincerity, frequently claiming that the Nixon administration is more interested in chalking up a peace agreement to its credit than finding what Arabs and Israelis both like to call a just settlement. However, for all that's written and said here about American pressure on Israel to accept a settlement that does not meet Jerusalem's demands, the Nixon administration is enjoying the greatest amount of popularity here since taking office. More than 52% of all Israelis apparently are pleased with the president's Middle East policies, according to recent polls. This is a tremendous increase from 15% when the president first announced his so-called even-handed Middle East policy. What did worry Israelis, however, was the worsening American economic crisis, since Jerusalem is directly tied to the U.S. dollar. Most Israelis now, though, are pleased with the administration's recent sweeping economic program. Government financial advisors and businessmen alike say it is the right step to strengthen all dollar-linked currencies, including the Israeli lira. What does trouble Israelis about America, however, is the permissiveness of middle-class young Americans, virtually all Jewish, who visit here. Too many of them, Israelis complain, bring with them drug habits and revolutionary rhetoric that influence their Israeli counterparts. And this, the Israelis say, definitely is not good for the Jews. This is Ken Lukoff at Freedom Square, Jerusalem.
The Middle East lies at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, once a base for the British Navy. With the phasing out of the British influence, the American Sixth Fleet had become a bulwark of strength in the area, somewhat diminished now as the Soviet Navy grows in strength in the eastern Mediterranean. Since World War II, the United States has been bolstering its influence on the western end of the Mediterranean in Spain.
Within the past year, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Agnew, and other American dignitaries have visited Spain. Prince Carlos, the Spanish king-to-be, has visited this country. There seems to be a spirit of cordiality between the two nations. But is there?
This is Tim Brown in Madrid. Not since Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas have relations at a political level been so cozy between the United States and Spain. But on an unofficial level, there is simmering discontent. Franco's political opponents strongly resent the U.S. military presence here and complain of what they term the American economic colonialism of their country. They point out that 35% of all foreign investment in Spain is American. An estimated $750 million have been invested by U.S. business, and over 100 of America's top 200 companies are in Spain. In fact, no other country's presence is more noticeable in the daily life of the country. U.S. military jets roar in and out of this air base near Madrid, as they do at other bases near Zaragoza and Seville. On the southern coast at Rota, Polaris-armed submarines leave to patrol the Mediterranean and the Atlantic. Despite the anti-American sentiments, mainly fomented by the left, demonstrations against the U.S. are rare in Spain. And the fact that this resentment has not boiled to the surface more often is in part a tribute to the general good manners of most Americans in Spain, and this includes the 1 million tourists that come annually. Most Spaniards also admit that the U.S. is to a great extent responsible for the tremendous economic strides that have lifted the country out of poverty. This is Tim Brown at the U.S. Air Base at Torrejon near Madrid.
American preoccupation with Europe, the Far East, the Middle East, tends to make us sometimes to forget a very loyal friend, Australia. It's been a quarter of a century since thousands of American GIs based there had a profound effect on Australian thinking.
This is Lionel Hudson on the outskirts of Canberra. Australia's federal capital is in the heart of the sheep country. It's spring here and the lambs are dropping. But Australians are facing up to another new season with a lot less joy. A new season in international affairs brought about largely by changes in United States policies. Whatever the outcome of America getting off the hook in Vietnam or of the dollar crisis, Australia's position in the Pacific will never be the same again. After years of holding onto Britain's hand and then America's, Australia is being forced willy-nilly into economic and political independence. Canberra was caught on the hop by the stepping up of the United States troop withdrawals from Vietnam and by the Nixon doctrine that Southeast Asian nations should do much more for themselves. President Nixon, said the Sydney Morning Herald, was now little concerned to consult his Pacific and Asian allies and, indeed, seemed less concerned to preserve their good opinion. The question was asked, was the United States reverting to a form of isolationism? So what, said one commentator. It's high time Australia stopped hearing after great powers in a self-important, ex-imperial, little brother kind of way, and most Australians agreed with him. Australians were warned the other day that their country had more chance of survival than many others as long as they changed from the present course of imitating America's mistakes. On top of this, there was a report of a big increase of American immigrants to Australia fleeing urban disorders and race problems. However, many Australians are curious at the fact that one-third of all American immigrants go home again. This is Lionel Hudson on the outskirts of Canberra.
In the foregoing segment, we've tried to present a cross-sectional view of American foreign policy. We're aware that American prestige is on the wane. It is too early to assess Mr. Nixon's attempt to establish better relations with Red China. But his move has the value of being positive, a step away from our drifting attitude. It is one of Mr. Nixon's two recent dynamic steps. The other is, of course, the so-called new economic policy. By cutting the dollar away from gold and by surcharging imports, the president has shaken the economic world. In this segment, we will give time to this matter. First, a report from the country most hard hit by the new economic doctrine.
This is Jack Russell in Tokyo. For Japan, it was both a very good and a very bad summer. The affluent Japanese in the largest numbers ever flocked to beach and mountain resorts, but they drove their Toyota and Honda cars home to the specter of what many are calling the Nixon Depression. When President Nixon announced he was imposing a 10% surcharge on all imports, the Japanese felt that the friendly giant had turned against them. businessmen openly cursed the U.S. president using the worst profanities in the Japanese language. But the anger is melting. The Japanese now are more worried about the impact of U.S. economic policies that already have forced the flotation of the yen on their economy. Daily television commentators, economists, and newspapers warn that weaker industries will go bankrupt, that there will be unemployment, and that both wages and the economy will be held down for months. But they are not blaming the United States solely for their problems. If anyone is being blamed now, it is Prime Minister Sato. A Japanese newspaper editor said Sato's government, by not earlier coming to terms with Washington on the trade problems, proved it had miscalculated the American response. Japanese businessmen don't want this to happen again. Every one of them hopes that somehow the 10% surcharge on their goods will be lifted. But one exporter said that in business we know only how to attack. We must now learn how to retreat gracefully in the economic Cold War with the United States. So far, anti-Americanism has been held in check. But if things really get bad, President Nixon and the United States may yet become villains in Japan. This is Jack Russell, NBC News, Tokyo.
It is ironic that the United States had to act to hold down Japan, a country it defeated in the last Great War. It is doubly ironic that the same policy was designed to hold down not only Japan, but our other major wartime opponent, Germany.
This is Leslie Collett in Berlin. The activity here in West Berlin's stock exchange has been centering around the stocks of West German companies, which send a high percentage of their exports to the United States. Their prices have been sliding for weeks. Talking to dozens of West German businessmen, industrialists, bankers, and economists, the following is the most frequently quoted reason for the present dilemma of the American economy: that the United States is no longer able to compete with the major industrial nations because too many American goods have simply grown too expensive in recent years. But as a prominent West German chemicals manufacturer puts it, all this could change as other countries follow West Germany and revalue their currencies, thus making American goods cheaper abroad. West German economist Dr. Horst Seidler explains the essential reason why the American dollar has lost its former international position, while the West German mark continues to be one of the world's hardest currencies.
We were free in our decisions to steer our economy according to our own wishes and opinions, more free than the Americans have been.
He shares the belief of many knowledgeable Germans that American-owned companies in Europe have contributed their share to the current economic and monetary troubles of the United States. Too many of these companies retained their profits in Europe for expansion there, rather than remitting them back to the United States. This is Leslie Collett at the Stock Exchange in Berlin.
West Germany is alarmed. The Japanese have had to revalue their currency. Thus, our new economic strategy has had a powerful effect on wartime foes. But it has also hurt a longtime friend, our good neighbor to the north.
This is Ralph Arrington in Ottawa. When Pierre Trudeau paid his first visit to Washington as Prime Minister of Canada, he offered a lighthearted comment on Canada-U.S. relations. Living next to the Americans, he said, is in some ways like sleeping with an elephant. No matter how friendly and even tempered the beast, one is affected by every twitch and grunt. Trudeau had cause to reflect on those words when he cut short a European vacation in the wake of President Nixon's drastic economic moves. With nearly 70% of its exports going to the United States, Canada primarily was concerned about the 10% import surcharge. Canada immediately appealed to the Nixon administration for a total exemption, arguing that Canada, with a floating dollar and no tariff barriers, did not contribute to the U.S. balance of payments problem. Prime Minister Trudeau pressed Canada's case for exemption in a radio TV address to the Canadian people, but the message was aimed at Washington.
We understand your problem. We sympathize wholeheartedly with your goal of a healthy economy. We suggest only that the application of your surcharge to Canadian exports contributes in no way to the attainment of that goal. A weak Canadian economy is of no help to the United States.
While voicing concern that thousands of Canadians could be thrown out of work by the U.S. import surcharge, Prime Minister Trudeau said there would be no retaliation on Canada's part. In the meantime, Canadians are trying to ride out the economic storm. This is Ralph Arrington reporting from Parliament Hill in Ottawa.
Governments come and governments go, but Switzerland has shown a remarkable talent for survival.
This is Robert Krohn, Geneva. The Swiss are known as the money managers of Europe, free trade champions in the true sense of the word, and also as citizens of the world's oldest democracy. As such, they are taking a jaundiced view of the United States today. To the Swiss, political and economic stability are national virtues. Therefore, they are surprised that the U.S. government, as they see it, has not been in control of America for quite a while, politically, socially, and now also in the economic field. Swiss exports to the United States, especially of watches, have been hit very hard by the 10% surcharge, plus the almost 10% revaluation of the Swiss franc that people here feel was forced upon them. And there's no relief in sight. The Swiss complain that the U.S. is letting them down. Many Swiss tend to forget, however, that the huge speculation against the weakening dollar of the past few months was operated to a large extent through Swiss banks, and that enormous profits were made before Washington finally presented the bill. So now the Swiss are sitting tight and hoping for the best. They may be grumbling under the pressure of Nixon's economic program, but responsible leaders and economists will admit that the sooner the U.S. puts its house in order, the better the things will work out for Switzerland and for everyone else in the long run. This is Robert Krohn, Geneva.
We continue now with a world reflection, how they see us. Here again, Wilson Hall.
It is almost 200 years since the 13 colonies broke ties with the British Empire, then at its peak of power. The split was clean and complete, but there has remained a spirit of association between the two nations.
This is David Weber in London. Economists here in Britain are still trying to assess the country's radically new financial relationship with the United States. It'll be some time before the pound and the dollar arrive at their natural parity, and it'll be even longer before British exporters learn how badly they're hurt by the new 10% tax on goods they sell to America. If the surcharge upsets them, they are cheered up by the revaluation of the yen, because this means they can now really compete with Japanese prices. What it amounts to is that the British still can't say whether President Nixon's economic surprise package of last month was a good thing or not. They were certainly unhappy about it at the time, not so much by what the president did, than how he did it. There was talk of his high-handedness, his lack of courtesy for not letting his foreign friends know of his plans in advance. And there were also some dark mutterings about the president playing fast and loose with the economies of the world just to gain a little political advantage at home. But those early grumblings have now given way to a kind of grudging respect, even admiration for Mr. Nixon. Here in the city, which is to London what Wall Street is to New York, bankers and stockbrokers are now beginning to say that the big shakeup from Washington was just the thing to get a little flexibility in the old fixed world money exchanges. As far as a lot of British economists are concerned, the tough new American economic policy may wind up helping Britain as much as it could help the United States. David Weber in the city of London.
European statesmen have tried to create a third force in the world, a buffer between the United States and the Soviet Union. France has played a leading role.
This is Aline Saarinen in Paris. Editorial and official opinions in France have been angry about the manner and sometimes the content of President Nixon's new economic policies. Even Le Monde, the old gray lady of the French press, refers consistently to, quote, the president's egocentric decisions. L'Express, the French magazine that's like Time or Newsweek, started its summary article by saying, the cowboy has come through the lawyer. President Nixon gave up his gentlemanly manners. He has refused to respect the rules of the monetary game. Although they don't want retaliations to start a trade war, all French opinion is enraged by the 10% surcharge. Giscard d'Estaing, the French finance minister, has been reiterating the French position. that the United States balance of payments deficit is caused by large-scale direct American investment in Europe, and that it is not up to the European countries to revalue upwards to save the dollar. Although the French position prevented concerted action by the common market, after the last French cabinet meeting, the government spokesman said France was anxious to find a common position, quote, that would affirm the personality of Europe and its weight in the world. The government also expressed its satisfaction with the two-tiered market. Olivier Wurmser, governor of the Banque de France, where we are now, says Europe shouldn't stop urging a devaluation of the dollar by a rise in the price of gold. He, too, is against revaluing the franc. But Le Monde now thinks the floating of the Japanese yen may shake the French out of their rigid stance. This is Aline Saarinen at the Banque de France in Paris.
American relief has found its way to nations all over the world. A good portion has gone to India.
This is Myron Belkine in New Delhi. Since 1951, the United States has given India nearly $10 billion in economic assistance. The amount represents 56% of all the foreign aid India has received. And yet, today, the United States has few friends in India. The reason is the United States policy of permitting arms shipments to Pakistan, which has always been considered India's arch enemy. One senior Indian foreign ministry official who deals directly with the United States expressed his lack of understanding of American foreign policy with this question. How does America, he asked, support a dictatorship in Pakistan against India, the world's largest democracy? When India and the Soviet Union signed a friendship treaty in early August, the Times of India said that America's friendship with Pakistan was indirectly responsible for the agreement. Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who herself has been critical of American policy, may be able to help improve Indo-American relations during her proposed visit to the United States in November. This is Myron Belkine of the Associated Press, outside the American Embassy in New Delhi.
We closed out our segment on foreign affairs with a report from Down Under, Australia. We close out this economic segment from another country, somewhat out of the mainstream. South Africa.
This is Ralph Elliott in Table Bay Docks, Cape Town. South Africans living in the southernmost country of the continent of Africa are very much aware of American economic affairs. The Republic produces 70% of the free world's gold, and a significant percentage of this finds its way into the vaults of Fort Knox. On the other side of the scale, the United States has $800 million in direct investment in the Republic and $270 million in indirect investment. And these are important influences in the economy of this country. Since the closure of the Suez Canal, the sea route around the Cape of Good Hope has been brought into sharper focus, both commercially and strategically, as it's now the only practical passage from the Western world to Eastern countries. And we at Cape Town, the halfway house, known to mariners as the Tavern of the Sea, know this. The magnitude of commercial shipping traffic has increased many times, and this growth rate is matched by the build-up of communist naval forces in the Indian Ocean. These political and commercial developments have had the effect of bringing South Africa more and more into the arena of international affairs. Along with that, the Republic views the economic pattern of events in the States with keener interest in terms of the dollar as the standard measure, or gold. Gold is the key factor between the States and South Africa, and here, Washington has shown an awareness of this vital economic link. This is Ralph Elliott in Table Bay Docks, Cape Town.
We've given time to consideration of the view others take of us with regard to foreign affairs and to economic matters. But how do they think we're doing in our domestic affairs? First, the French.
George V. Lewis, Paris. When New York's Mayor John Lindsay switched parties, declaring himself a Democrat, Le Monde, France's most authoritative newspaper, made the event the subject of its famous front-page editorial, the one dealing with the major international topic of the day. This gives some indication of how much deep concern there is here for every significant turn in America's domestic affairs. Right now, the French are eyeing the 1972 presidential campaign with nearly as much interest as Americans. The names of the six or seven leading contenders for the Democratic nomination already are surprisingly well known here. The widespread French belief of only a year or two ago that the United States was inevitably headed for racial upheaval and violent revolution has largely subsided, giving way to the view, voiced, for example, in a recent issue of the big magazine Paris Match, that there's nothing much wrong with the United States that more capable leadership would not help solve. Thus, the extraordinary interest in 1972. By and large, President Nixon isn't treated as critically here as in some other countries. The big reason for this is that he's considered pro-French and pro-Gaullist. But he generates no real enthusiasm. And as a French opposition leader, François Mitterrand, has put it, the French don't think that Mr. Nixon has the answers to America's problems. George V. Lewis, NBC News, Paris.
And how do the Russians see us?
This is Ed Stevens in Moscow. The Soviet press and radio never portray America as anything but a sick society coming apart at the seams, torn by crime and race violence, plagued by inflation and unemployment, demoralized by dope and porno, ruled by a ruthless military-industrial power structure. American democracy a sham, civil rights, including freedom of the press, a myth. Soviet correspondents in America always confirm this one-sided picture. But there are other sources of information. The Voice of America commands a vast audience despite jamming. The trickle of Soviet visitors to America is gradually increasing. Learned periodicals of limited circulation give factual reports on American progress and achievements. The latest U.S. scientific and technical literature is available to specialists. Many educated Russians who publicly parrot the party line on America change their tune in private. Thus, publication of the secret Pentagon papers was officially played up as new proof of American depravity. But one most prominent citizen, who has to remain nameless, voiced glowing admiration for a press and for patriotic individuals who dared expose their rulers' mistakes and abuses of power, something unthinkable in the Soviet Union. Even the average man likes and admires Americans, despite the official line. As one factory worker remarked, I don't believe that people who can land on the moon almost like their own backyard are in such bad shape.
This is Ed Stevens in Moscow.
We've heard reports from American correspondents, but now the viewpoint of a non-American. David Webster of the British Broadcasting Corporation, stationed here in New York. Mr. Webster, do you think the president's announcement of the wage price freeze, particularly the import surcharge, came as a blow to the ordinary Englishman?
I don't think it came as a blow to the ordinary Englishman. It might have come as a blow to the bankers and the economists and some of the politicians, but if they were smart, they must have seen it coming. I think the ordinary Englishman is probably dimly aware that the relationship which has been maintained between the United States and the rest of the world ever since the end of the war in 45, that phase is coming to an end. There have been signs of its coming to an end for a long time, and they are now aware that a different kind of relationship is going up.
Do you think that perhaps there might have been a feeling among some of the British that they're glad to see us in the same old bucket of being a little broke and not being able to pay our bills?
Oh, there's always an element of that. Sort of feeling that, at last they've understood what economics are about. There was a certain, among the profession, there was a certain irony in the fact that here you are having great arguments about wage freeze and price controls, which is precisely the argument we've been going through for so long, and it all sounded terribly familiar to us. On the other hand, I don't think anybody in his right mind wishes to see the United States in a state of penury. Of course, the United States is not in a state of penury. They're merely having to adjust themselves to the realities of their situation in the world, in which they have become overextended. I think they realize that in terms of their military policies, but also overextended in terms of their economic role in the world.
Do you think there's a better understanding in England now, David Webster, a better understanding of our racial problems, which we have now that certainly racial problems, color problems, have come upon England?
There is perhaps a greater recognition. Whether there is greater understanding, I'm not sure, because the problems are very different. The problem is very different in scale. our problems tend to be problems of immigration, which happen to be related to race, rather than problems of race as such. See, a large part of our problem is in fact partly an Asian problem, a Pakistani problem, which relates not so much to the color of the man's skin, but to a totally different cultural background and sometimes an inability to actually speak English.
How is our racial progress, or lack of same, viewed, the busing, the ghettos, and so forth?
Well, it's viewed with some alarm. This is largely because, as the nature of news reporting, we tend to hear the bad news rather than the good news. And at least in this country, you are starting from a basic proposition, which says that it is the purpose of the country to make the situation better. Unlike some countries, you aren't starting from a position of where the purpose of the country is to hold down any one group. And you're going through a whole series of difficult transition phases, sometimes resulting in violence, in pursuit of these aims.
Think we're making any progress?
I think you are. I don't think it's a straight-line progress. I think you're going in fits and starts, and sometimes you go along one direction, and it's as far as you can go in that direction, so you change tack, and you start trying to deal with the problem the other way, which is right, because it's an extremely complex problem.
Turning to foreign affairs for a moment, and David Webster, how are we doing, how do we seem to be doing, I should say, about Vietnam, that terrible thing that's hung over our heads for years now?
Well, you are seen to be going through a long and tortuous process of trying to extricate yourself from the situation. I suppose you'd find as many different opinions among people in Britain as to precisely how you should get out of it as you'd find among people in America as how you should get out of it. I think it's recognized in Britain that it's not a question of easy solutions, that there is no easy solution left to America.
Not just Vietnam, but in many other areas of endeavor.
I think the general reaction in Britain would be one of delight that after many years your China policy would seem to be taking upon a different dimension. I think basically British people would be very happy about this, that it's a sign of coming to terms with the whole problem of Southeast Asia and what we cheerfully call the Far East, and the people in the East call the East.
Do you think it's a little late in coming? Not you, but again,
I think most British people would say it is very late in coming. But it's comparatively easy for a nation which has severely modified its world role to be critical of another nation which is still trying to deal with the problem.
Another problem in the Middle East. Are they as critical of our attempts in the Middle East to get some sort of interim agreement, at least?
I don't think that there's any great body of opinion either way in Britain on American policy in the Middle East. They regard it as a great international problem in which America is trying to do her bit and British trying to do their bit and so on. It's not a major... The debate about American policy in the Middle East is not a major issue in Britain. The Middle East may be, but American policy is not.
I remember particularly in 1957 when I was in Britain just after that war, how angry so many people were with the United States for cutting off the, or making, as they saw it, France and Britain, Israel, stop picking on Nasser.
Well, that was a great internal debate in Britain, in some ways similar to the arguments you're having in this country about your relationship to Southeast Asia. And the United States made moves at that time in relation to that area, which were resented by many British people. On the other hand, a lot of other British people thought they were correct.
We've wandered around foreign affairs and economics and domestic affairs. What do you see, David Webster, as the biggest problem facing the United States today?
Well, I don't quite know whether to describe it as the biggest problem or the greatest hope. One of the things which I find myself arguing with Americans about is that Americans, being very outspoken and very open people in the way they discuss their own problems, get into a kind of intellectual masochism. They say, God, we've got all these problems, and they get very upset about it, and they argue about them ad infinitum, and this is right, and this is one of the great strengths of the United States. The thing which interests me about the United States at this stage, looking back over the last 10 or 15 years of my experience of this country, is that It is going through a process of maturing. It realizes that not all problems are necessarily soluble. It realizes that there is a gap between the ideal of what they think the United States is about in the world and what, in fact, might be actually practical to achieve. And this coming to terms with the reality, with the limits of strength, with the limits of problem-solving, perhaps taking a less quaintly Victorian attitude towards the inevitability of progress, this, I think, is a great sign of hope, and it's a sign of growing up.
This is Wilson Hall, NBC News.
You've been listening to Second Sunday. A World Reflection, How They See Us, was written and produced by James Quigley. Directed by Edward Smith. Associate Director, Albert Reyes. Technical Supervision, John Rice. Second Sunday is produced under the supervision and control of NBC News. This is Bill McCoy.